RIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines is an end in sight to Sudan's political crisis. That question as military rulers agree to reinstate the ousted prime minister. Unrest in several U.S. cities over the acquittal of a white vigilante. And anger and protests rising in Europe over COVID restrictions, with the Netherlands gripped by fiery riots for a second night. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. A big story we're following today, a major development now unfolding in Sudan's politics and military, is to reinstate ousted Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok following an agreement reached with civilian leaders. The National Ummah Party says Hamdok will form a cabinet of technocrats and all political detainees will be released. The development comes on the heels of weeks-long protests to demand the return of a civil government. The country was thrust into chaos after top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan toppled the transitional government late last month and detained civilian leaders, including the prime minister. At least 40 anti-coup protesters have been killed since then. The military takeover and the deadly crackdowns have received widespread condemnations, including from the African Union. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Muzan Al-Neil, a non-resident fellow of Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. Thank you very much for joining us. If you could please tell us about how this all came to be. It did come as a very big surprise development to have the Prime Minister back. Was this something that you observers were expecting to happen?
We were hearing, thank you first for having me, and we started to hear rumors about the return of the Prime Minister early last evening. As early as the rumors were heard, we saw statements and social media posts from resistance committees assuring the public that regardless of this, whether this rumor is true or not, today's march, the Millions March of November 21st, is taking place, and that the demands of the protesters are not limited to the return of the Prime Minister or his cabinet, and that they still stand by their three no's, which is no compromise, no negotiation, and no partnership with the military.
So what does this mean for the future of Sudan? Are you looking to a hopeful future?
We are looking towards a hopeful future, and we saw that since the day of the coup and the way that the people reacted to the coup and the commitment of the Sudanese public to the civilian leadership and to a civilian government and to total removal of the military from politics in Sudan. What this news tells us is that it seems a good portion of the ruling bloc or the political class have a very limited understanding of the reality in the streets. If they think that the return of Hamdok can return stability to the country, they seem to not understand or listen to the clear demands of the public. There is a lot of danger in that, given that those are the people who are currently, to a far extent, leading the political process, how they do not understand what the requirements of the public are, and that they do not understand that no stability can happen without satisfying the requirements and the demands of the public, which start with and do not end with total removal of the military from the political process in Sudan.
And how much do you think the military would be committed to that pledge? Well, we've seen them time and time again over the past months actually reneging on that promise.
I will actually quote the statement from the Umbedda Resistance Committee, one of the neighborhood resistance committees that have been participating in leading the protest. And this morning, after the news went out, their statement on social media started with, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And shame on all of those who think that the military can commit to any partnership of any sort. That is not true. They will be going away with the military if they choose to link themselves to such a partnership. The public is not fooled, the streets are not fooled, and we will see that in a couple of hours when the march takes place, which is the November 21st Millions March against the military.
Thank you very much, Ms. Muzan Al-Neil, a non-resident fellow at Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy. Moving on, at least four protesters are wounded in Burkina Faso during the third day of demonstrations against the French army. The violence broke out in the town of Kaya when French and Burkinabe forces tried to break the protesters' blockade on a French military convoy heading for Niger. It was not immediately clear which side opened fire on the demonstrators. The protesters accused French forces of working with armed groups and demand the removal of the foreign forces from their country. They say militant attacks increase whenever a French military convoy passes through Burkina Faso. And fury and reactions in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who shot dead two anti-racism protesters last year. The court verdict that the shootings by Kyle Rittenhouse were in self-defense is triggering a lot of heated debate. There have been protests in several cities. In Chicago, Black Lives Matter protesters turned out carrying signs that read, "White supremacy equals terrorism." Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida, Minneapolis, and Minnesota. And the verdict has raised fierce criticism of the justice system and its preferential treatment of white supremacists. It is also a renewed debate over the boundaries of gun rights and self-defense in the U.S. And Chile will hold general elections on Sunday to choose the country's next president, lawmakers, and regional council members. Nearly 15 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Seven candidates were vying for the presidency, with recent opinion polls showing two frontrunners. One is Gabriel Boric, a congressman who represents the left-wing coalition and was a leader of the student movement. Another main contender is José Antonio Kast from the far-right Christian Social Front Coalition. He is a lawyer and former congressman as well. A runoff will be held in December 9th if none of these candidates obtains an outright majority. Voters will also elect all 155 members of the lower house of Congress, 27 of 50 senators, and regional council representatives. And the UK's move to label Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist organization is drawing widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measure at Israel's behest. It says that the designation is an unjustified aggression against Palestinian people and it will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Hamas has also condemned the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
To consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has also condemned Britain's decision. Iran has denounced the British measure as well. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting attacks. The UK decision adds a political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing. And Israeli forces have shot and killed Palestinians in the old city of Al-Quds. We're now joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, to tell us more.
It's reports from the Israeli military and the Israeli police saying that two Palestinians entered the old town of Al-Quds near Bab al-Silsila, one of the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. One of those Palestinians opened a fire at a group of settlers, wounding two settlers, and two other police officers were wounded by shrapnel. The Israeli forces there immediately opened fire and killed this Palestinian at the spot. The other one, who was holding an object, according to the Israeli military, succeeded to escape from the scene. Now, Israeli medics are saying that one of the settlers had succumbed to his injuries. He was transferred to one of the Israeli hospitals near in Al-Quds, and then they revealed that he succumbed to his injuries. So in this operation, we can say one Israeli settler was killed, and the three others were wounded. Two of them are Israeli police officers, but from the shrapnel, according to the Israeli military reports. And we can confirm, according to Israeli reports, that a Palestinian was shot dead in that area, claiming that he tried to attack Israelis there. Up to the moment, we have no confirmation from the Palestinian Ministry of Health, because in such cases, the Israeli military and the Israeli medics are the ones who issue such reports, and then they inform the Palestinian Ministry of Health.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kandel, live from Ramallah. Moving on, scuffles break out in the Netherlands as protests against the government's new coronavirus restrictions continue for a second consecutive night. Latest footage show clashes between police and protesters in The Hague. Thousands of people also took to the streets in the capital, Amsterdam, despite strong presence of security forces. This follows an outbreak of violence on Friday night in Rotterdam. Three people were injured in the city after police fired shots and water cannons to disperse angry demonstrators. Dozens of people were also arrested. Similar anti-lockdown protests were also held in other European countries on Saturday, including Denmark, Croatia, and Austria. Tens of thousands take to the streets of the Austrian capital ahead of the nation's fourth general lockdown, affecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike.
This is just one of several rallies taking place across the city just the day after the government announced that vaccinations will become mandatory from February.
Around 2 million of the country's 9 million residents have refused to get vaccinated.
I've not been vaccinated, and I believe this is a bluff on the part of the government. They want to put people under pressure. When vaccination becomes mandatory, I will stay at home. I believe everyone should be able to make their own choice.
I'm here because I'm against the vaccination for everybody. I want to decide myself. It's my body, and so I don't want to tell anyone to me that I have to go to vaccination.
The federal government has blamed the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ, for fueling public anger at a time of national crisis. Police forces confirmed that right-wing extremists, including convicted neo-Nazis, had taken part in the rallies, which remained largely peaceful, despite several instances of clashes and arrests. Austria is now reporting well over 15,000 new infections a day, with the total death toll almost reaching 12,000 people. Health experts say without compulsory vaccinations, the country will only stumble into new lockdowns every 3 or 4 months. Homolezki, Vienna.
Now, political commentator Lara Sasazi says European governments have to restrict their people's liberty due to the coronavirus pandemic.
It's a matter of a new variant of the virus that is evolving, and then you have to combine, somehow juggle between liberties and need of people to go out and go to a restaurant, especially now that Christmas is coming. But then there are other problems, like winter, that because of the cold weather, probably this virus is going to, well, some people say that if the virus comes from a certain kind of weather, then the opposite kind of weather is going to be, well, I'm not a biologist, but a cold weather might make people stay indoors, stay home, but then, I don't know, that could be like a source of incubation for the virus. In any case, the thing is
keep the windows closed.
There's like a baseline. People got to get vaccinated. People got to continue with social distancing. People got to use masks. And if you have relaxation, so people are not that careful, I mean, those that haven't vaccinated themselves at all, or they only have one vaccine, that is the problem. And that's the argument in the United States, that they say that there's like 30% people that haven't vaccinated, and the amount of deaths, the increases are in that kind of the population. So it's difficult. It's difficult when you want liberty, freedoms, but at the same time, governments have to take this as a public health measure, a matter of life and death. So it's quite difficult. Yes.
Well, we have some breaking news coming in right now. Hamas has slammed Israel for killing a Palestinian in Al-Quds. Hamas resistance movement says the resistance against occupation will continue. We will be bringing you more updates on that breaking news. But the World Health Organization has also expressed concern over the rising COVID-19 figures across Europe. The agency has warned that some 500,000 people could die by March next year unless urgent action is taken to stem the spread of the virus. The WHO believes impending a winter season, low vaccination rates, and the faster spreading Delta variant of the virus contribute to the surge. The warning comes as several European nations have posted record caseloads and announced partial or full lockdowns. The International Organization for Migration says the situation still remains tough for migrants stranded on the border between Belarus and Poland. The organization's chief of mission in Belarus says the migrants still have no access to basic living standards despite an improvement in their conditions. Thousands of migrants have been camping for weeks on the Belarusian side of the border with Poland. They are trying to cross into the European Union, but Poland blocks their entry. Warsaw accuses Minsk of fomenting the crisis, a claim that Belarus denies. Minsk started repatriating some of these migrants to Iraq on Thursday. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, November 21st, 2021. I'm Atefe Erfani hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any messages for our great listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. We hope you enjoy your autumn times, and of course, we wish you a very happy spring for those of our dear listeners who are living in the Southern Hemisphere. So please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. As usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because they enable us to provide a better service to our great listeners around the world. So all of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. So here, I truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have sent us reception reports, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Paul Makuza from Uganda, and Thomas Biliauskas from Lithuania. So Thomas, Mizanur Rahman, and Paul, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to your radio, IRB English Radio. And here, I truly appreciate those of our great listeners around the world who have sent us emails from around the world, including Shivanta Bol from India, Fabricio Andrade Silva from Brazil. Again, from India, we have an email from Mubashir Hussein, Asher. From Spain, we have an email from Artur Fernandez Lorella. And again, from India, we have an email from Mutaram Kaga. After a short break, I will be back with these great emails from around the world. Please stay with us. Back. This is Listeners Special, and here we are emails and letters from around the world. And first of all, we start with an email from Shivandapol from India. Shivandapol is one of our regular listeners who says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, greetings from India. I am Shivandapol and I'm from Murshidabad, India. I am a regular listener of IRIB English Radio. Now, your reception is moderate and the signal strength is good. I love your programs, news and current affairs program. I'm interested about culture, lifestyle of Iranian people, historical places, etc. My hobby is radio listening and collecting stamps, coin, QSL card, program schedule, stickers, badge, calendar, and other items from international radio stations. Thank you. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Iran, from Tehran, Iran, to Shivan Dupol from India, and many thanks for sending us this great email. IRM English Radio really appreciates you for sending us email from India, Shivan Dupol. Thank God you liked everything about our radio, IRM English Radio. As you said, you enjoyed the quality of our program because you said the reception is moderate and the signal strength is good in your region. It seems that you love our programs, the news, the current affairs program, and you're interested about the culture and the lifestyle of Iranian people and historical places because we broadcast different programs, including Close Up Iran and many different programs about Iran at IRM English Radio, and it seems that you liked it so much, and that's great. So you have the hobby of radio listening and collecting stamps, coin, QSL cards, program schedule stickers, but unfortunately at the time of pandemic we can't send our great listeners the souvenirs and the promotional items of IRM English Radio, and at this time we just can send you an eQSL card. Anyway, please accept it from us. And of course, after the pandemic, we will send our dear listeners promotional items of IRM English Radio as before. Yes, we had the tradition of sending these items to our dear listeners, including the postcards with the monuments of Iran. But now we just send you eQSL cards. Please accept it from us. Anyway, thank you for writing this great email to us. Please tell us your views about our programs in your upcoming emails, Shivan Dupol from India. And from Brazil, we have an email from Fabricio Andrade Silva. So he says, "Dear friends at IRM English Radio, greetings from Brazil. I just wanted to remind you via this email to send me a QSL card, and that you do not need to send it via postal system. Just fill it up with my reception report information and send me a photo of it here by email. I'm quite fine with receiving an eQSL. I will be glad for that. Thanks, and have a nice day. Salam and warm greetings to you, Fabricio Andrade Silva from Brazil." Yes, greetings from Iran to you. Thank you for understanding the situation. Yes, we will send you an eQSL card. Please accept it from us. Yes, thank you for accepting it. And we are so glad to have you with us. Write to us soon and tell us your views about the broadcast of IRM English Radio. Fabricio Andrade Silva from Brazil. So after a short break, I will be back with another email from India, from Mubashir Hussain Asher, one of our regular listeners. As I said, Mubashir Hussain Asher from India has sent us an email. He says, "Dear friends, me and my club members are very much interested in your programs. These programs give us full information regarding your country, Iran. We also would like to thank you for your informative and up-to-date website. It is a great website with great choice of programs which enables us to listen to your radio online whenever we want. Salam and warm greetings to you, Mubashir Hussain Asher from India, and we send our appreciations to you for sending us this great email. And we're so glad to have you and your club members as our listeners. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL as a confirmation, of course. So, you enjoy the programs. As you said, you get full information regarding our country, Iran. Yes, I think IRIB and IRIB English Radio, and of course, in general, IRIB is the best source for giving information about the Islamic Republic of Iran. So we hope you enjoy the programs. As you said, you find it informative. Thank you very much for writing this email to us. Mubashir Hussain Asha from India, write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you. And from Spain, we have an email from one of our regular listeners, from Arthur Fernandez Lorella. Arthur says, thank you very much for your message and informing about the QSL sent from your radio. I hope to receive one of them as a confirmation of my old reception reports. Thanks in advance. Have a nice week. Let me wish you all the best and stay healthy. Salam and warm greetings to you, Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain, and many thanks for sending us this email. Of course, we at IRB English Radio wish you all the best in life. Peace, joy, good tidings, and of course, health. And we're so happy that have you with us. Yes, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Write to us soon. We're looking forward to hearing from you soon and reflect your views in your upcoming emails. Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain. After a short break, I will be back with another email. Welcome back. You just heard a piece of traditional Iranian music. Do you enjoy it? I was wondering if you enjoy these pieces of traditional Iranian music. Maybe you can reflect it in your emails or letters. Well, from India, as I said, we have an email from Mutaram Kaga. Mutaram Kaga from India says, hi, I am a new listener of Iranian English Radio Language Service, that is IRIB English Radio. I listen to your radio programs and visit your website time to time, and I have to say that both of them are interesting, but usually I only look at your news in the website. Please send me a QSL card or even an EQSL for confirmation. Thank you. Salam and warm greetings to you, and welcome to the world of IRIB English Radio. We're so glad to have you with us as a new listener. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation, because at the time of pandemic, it's not possible to send you a paper QSL card. So please keep in touch with us and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. Mutaram Kaga from India. Please stay with us. And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, I thank Thomas Biliaskas, Mizanur Rahman, Paul Makuza, Mutaram Kaga, Shivan Paul, Fabricio Andrade Silva, Mubashir Hussain Asher, Arthur Fernandez Lorella, all of them for sending us the reception reports and emails and letters from around the world. We wish you all the best. Keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and have a good time. We'll be right back.
as your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More signs of a country divided. That's the reaction of many Americans after Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all counts. He had taken an automatic weapon to a protest, shooting and killing two people and wounding another. Many people were shocked by the verdict and say it's about white privilege, and others say justice was served. Stay with us as we look at this ever-increasing divide in the United States. I'm going to start off by crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to see you. Colin, I mean, it's just so familiar. I just don't even realize how many times we've had this discussion over the years of something like this. Tell me what's being said on that side of things.
Well, a lot of people like myself, Marzia, were not surprised at this verdict. I mean, here you have a young white guy. Many people said he characterized him as a boy. He was 17 at the time of the incident, but now he's officially a man at age 18. But yet still, they, in some of the narratives that were coming from the U.S. here, they still characterized him as a boy. Of course, diminishing his accountability in the incident, where he took the lives of two people and then maimed another person. And so when you look at the optics of a man who, or a boy at the time, had a gun that is intended to kill people and goes into a protest where things are very volatile and unpredictable, one can almost expect that the outcomes may not be typically favorable with that. And then when you see someone walking away to live the rest of their life as a free man, despite having taken the lives of two people, there are a lot of people who think that a grave injustice was done here. Now, like you alluded to before, on the other side, there are those who said, well, he legally had the gun, he was allowed to be on public streets during that protest, and he was defending himself. So the jury ruled or decided in the correct direction. And that's where you see there are two schools of thought, two ideals, two understandings of the principles of America, where you can have a gun and you could exacerbate a situation. But if that situation turns on you, even though you might have been the one to instigate it, you legally have the right to defend yourself and obviously take a life without any type of reprisal. And I think that's what people are having problems dealing with as they try to process this verdict, that it was legally okay, but ethically, it was really an inhumane act that was committed by a boy who is now considered a man in American society.
I mean, what you just said, legally okay, and one would wonder if it was a black teen had done that, if it would have been legally okay. Thanks so much for that update out of D.C., Colin Campbell. I'd like to welcome our guests to the spotlight, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit. And writer and rights activist Yane Nadako out of Philadelphia.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
We'll cross over to Philadelphia and start this off with Yane. Thanks so much again for being with us. Your overall opinion of the verdict?
Well, I think that, you know, it's nuanced, as was discussed by the previous correspondent, in that what we observed is that there was a lot of consideration for the humanity, overwhelm, bad mistakes, youth of, you know, Rittenhouse. And that's something that consistently happens, where there's a willingness to care about whomever the perpetrator may be when that perpetrator is white. And that same kind of consideration and care is generally not extended to people who are not white. And so I think that when you look at a system where you have individuals who have actually had acts of self-defense over the course of decades of people actually really truly attacking and oppressing them directly or through as members of a larger community, and those people are in prison sometimes for decades. We've got a large number of political prisoners and in the U.S. right now who are in prison for having defended themselves and protected their lives against aggressive violence in a context that we know has always been very violent. And there's very little to no consideration given to the circumstances of what happened when people are fighting for their cases. You know, when you see repeatedly that there are these efforts that these vigilantes take on the flip side and actually establish the aggression, and then, you know, when that comes back on them, protect themselves from the aggression that they created in their engagement of the conflict, they're given all of this consideration. And so it just really speaks to what, speaking of political prisoners, political prisoner from Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal, said about the law here in the United States, which is that it means whatever the white men of that time want it to mean. It's not universally applied. It's not Okay. It's created as if it's objective, but it's not universally applied.
All right, stay with me, Yanhe. Let me get Abayomi in on this discussion. Abayomi, your take in general, I mean, if he was a black teenager walking in the street with an automatic weapon, then use his weapon to kill and wound, kill two people, wound another, do you think that the court would have looked at the case in the same way? I think that's the question of the day for especially people living outside the United States who perhaps can't understand this whole situation as well. Abayomi, I can't hear you. Okay, I think you're muted. I think your mic is muted. Okay, I'm going to come back to you. Hopefully we can clear this up. The technical side of things, we can get this done. I'll go back to Yanhe. Yanhe, the same question. I mean, because especially when you're talking to the international audience, a lot of times people cannot really understand racism in the United States in the way that it is. And right. When they see a case like this, and they're like, well, of course, perhaps then, okay, Abayomi, I think I have your voice. Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
So stay with me, Yanhe. I'm going to go back to Abayomi. Thanks so
yes,
much.
Sir.
I'm glad we got that technical issue cleared. Did you hear the question, or should I repeat it, Abayomi?
Yeah, I was saying that Tamir Rice in Cleveland several years ago was 12 years old. And he was playing with a toy gun in a public park. And a white man called 911 and said it was a child playing with a gun. It's probably harmless. Well, if it was harmless, why are you calling the police? So the dispatcher called the police and said it was a black man in the park with a gun, calling a gun. And two white police officers showed up and gunned him down within a matter of seconds. The question is almost rhetorical. This would not be the same discussion if you had a young African-American who was charged with killing two whites. And it's interesting that Rittenhouse killed two other white people and wounded a third person. One of them was Jewish. So it just goes to show even whites who are demonstrating against racism in the United States are subject to brutality, to vigilante violence, and that's just the reality that we're dealing with.
Yes, and Yanhe, I mean, we witnessed some very interesting acts during this case. I mean, such as the judge allowing him, Rittenhouse, to choose his own jury by lot. The judge said that people feel better when they are in control. In so many ways, it's so mind-boggling because we have seen time and time again the dehumanization process, for example, when people of color are arrested or are held on trial, put on trial, and then we see this basically the judge talking about needing control, that person. I mean, it's so mind-boggling. Your take on and so many of the situation that took place during this case.
Well, you know, there's a message that I hear. You know, we talk about the messaging that goes out through the actions and activities. You know, we talk about dog whistles, signals that you give. When you look at this case, you look at the case of Ahmaud Arbery, who was gunned down by two vigilante, individuals while taking a jog. There's a message that's going out. Even when you look at how Dylan Ruth, the young man who went to the church and shot up, a church of people who welcomed him into the church and how they treated him after, you know, during the arrest process and route to the prison, stopping and getting them little something to eat.
Right.
There's a message that's being delivered about what you're doing and whether or not what you're doing is actually aligned with the goals of the larger establishment. And whether, therefore, it will be actually really treated punitively when they do these things. So there's a message that these people are actually aligned and deserve protection because what they did is actually fits the goals and making sure that there's a certain communities that stay in their place as it relates to this hierarchical oppressive system. So that's what I hear in that situation. And one thing I just want to mention is that we've not only had the example of Tamir Rice, who was shot down with a toy gun within seconds of being encountered by the police, we also have examples of quite a number of fully grown, clearly grown white men who have been in public places where there were crowds of people with actual definitive guns waving them and being talked down by the police instead of being shot down.
Right. Abayomi, what does this do to the psyche of African Americans in general, living this day in and day out? And of course, we understand different parts of the country perhaps is somewhat different. But in general, this type of systemic racism is part of the soul of the United States. What does it do to the psyche of people living with this day in and day out? I think that part of it is really not talked about enough.
I think that W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the double consciousness, and you have to, as a black person in North America, you have to be aware all the time, particularly when you're confronting the authorities, that you could be severely harmed or killed. And you know, the whole book that was written in the 1960s about black rage, from a psychiatric standpoint, is a reality. So yes, you do have to be extremely aware and extremely conscious about your racial identity and skin color in the United States, and also whites as well. This case illustrates clearly that if they come out in solidarity with African Americans, they could easily be killed or stigmatized for life.
It's interesting you talked about the solidarity. I want to look at the solidarity, Yane, on the other side of Rittenhouse, because the funding for his legal case, there was so much money raised for it. I mean, it sounds similar to back in St. Louis, and we saw Mike Brown being killed, and we saw the cop who did that and raised so much money for his defense. Let's talk about that divide and that side of things. That what is it then that will bring this type of solidarity for someone who obviously has killed people, but others feel that it's their responsibility to give them all the support that they can, even financial support?
Well, it's solidarity with the ideas of what is called white supremacy. I don't like that term because there's nothing supreme about these behaviors and actions, but that is what it is that people are taking a position on the side of, and they know that that's what they're doing. They're taking a position that what he did was heroic or necessary, and that he needs to be protected. And it's really his whiteness that I believe is drawing people to provide that kind of support, and their desire to continue to perpetuate these systems that give them a feeling of having a leg up, or the opportunity to get a leg up, and what for most people it would be their whiteness would provide for them. So I perceive that as being people are right now, we're in a country that is really asking people to choose between the side of humanity and the side of white supremacy. And so some people are making that choice, and they're making the choice on the side of white supremacy consciously or unconsciously, because there are parts of the society that don't actually engage with a large number of the diverse parts of the population to actually know and understand what it's like, especially in some of these urban environments and some of these under-resourced environments that don't even understand what the environment is like. And that ignorance enables them to continue to be aligned outside of their and against their class interest with this white supremacist system that continues to oppress many of those people as well.
Right. Well, Abayomi, how do you explain what appears to be this deep disdain for black people in certain official circles in the United States, and obviously certain individuals? Still, even in 2021, there is a type of hatred that, again, perhaps people who haven't seen it cannot understand, that an individual that you don't even know, that you could have such deep resentment towards it. Explain this to my international audience, please.
It goes back to the period of enslavement. It was necessary for the white ruling class in the United States to demonize, to make it appear as if African people were inherently inferior. They needed to be controlled, they had to be exploited, and they had to be converted to the European belief systems. So this is the origin of it. In order to maintain that system, they had to institutionalize these theories. And then even after the Civil War and the purported liberation of African people from enslavement, in order to maintain the same system of racial hierarchy and national oppression and economic exploitation, they had to continue this myth that African people were genetically inferior to whites. And even today, in academic circles in the United States, you still have these theories that are being advanced. And it becomes even more important today because you have a rising minority that is becoming a majority. It will be a majority within perhaps 20 to 25 years, a collective majority, being black, brown, Middle Eastern, Asian, and indigenous people will be a majority collectively in the United States. So they have to reinstitute another form of Jim Crow and apartheid. That's what the whole debate is around critical race theory in the schools. Critical race theory came out of the law schools in the United States many decades ago. Yet they use it as a buzzword, as a wedge issue to justify not teaching the history of enslavement, the history of the forced removal and genocide of indigenous people, the history of the Civil War, that it was based upon whether or not the United States would be a slave system or a capitalist system, the suppression of African political rights, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, all of that. They want to suppress the teaching of this so they can rationalize or attempt to rationalize the continuation of this white supremacist system.
Yone, we've seen protests after the verdict taking place in several cities. Can a system which has been built and has profited from racism actually change itself? And I guess the question would be, why would it change itself? I mean, these demonstrators, protesters are demanding a change in the justice system, but your take on that?
Yeah, I think that this system is not going to change itself, and I don't think that people are going to change the system unless they change it over it with a new system that's replacing it. And a lot of people are beginning to understand the imperative to actually just build something that works for everyone and not only for a small select few. And I think part of the challenge is to help people who actually do have the same material interests to be able to operate with that understanding and not be manipulated by the ways that those who are in conflict with those material interests are pitting groups against each other while continuing to keep pressure from above from below.
So what is key? Staying with you, Yana. So what is key
that
here?
Is going to be able to be transformed. And I think that I personally believe that it is not a good use of time to put a lot of energy into that. Certainly, I think that there are things that people need to do in order to obtain relief from the violent ways that the system itself in our communities. But what we really need is for people thinking about what new things we can have and building something together collectively that takes care of all of the needs of the whole community.
Okay, well, Abayomi, there have been growing calls in the United States in general about secession and having the country break up and several autonomous regions. Would something like this help the racism issue in the United States? Or what do you see as key? What has to happen to change this status quo?
Yeah, the overall system has to be thrown out, and it has to be a new system instituted. And in terms of partition, you know, the issue involving the Civil War between 1861 and 1865 killed over a million people. And dislocated many more. So it's a serious question. And we can see the seeds of a coming civil war, another civil war in the United States in the 21st century. How can these issues be resolved short of some type of violent explosion or conflict when you have a situation where whites can at will not only kill blacks, they kill whites who express solidarity with blacks. So it's a very serious